It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what game shows do you watch or maybe have fond memories of watching back in the day? We'll talk to the curator of the new National Archive of Game Shows. First, big technology companies have been a target for both Republicans and Democrats in Congress in recent years. Last week, a package of antitrust bills aimed at big companies like Google, Facebook, and Apple cleared their first hurdle by making it past the House Judiciary Committee. The six bills would do things like make it harder for companies to buy up competitors, bar them from using their platforms to unfairly promote their own products, and make it easier for people to move their data from one company's device to another. The bills have some bipartisan support, but lawmakers in both parties have also voiced concerns about the proposals, so their fate in the House is up in the air. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Congress take antitrust action against big technology companies? What concerns specifically do you have about how they operate and what they're doing? Do you have questions about what our antitrust laws do and don't say and to what extent they can be used in these situations? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. John Mayo is a professor of economics, business, and public policy at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business. He is also the executive director of the Georgetown Center for Business and Public Policy and an expert on economics and antitrust law. John, welcome to Central Time.
Rob, it's nice to be here. Thank you very much.
There's a lot of detail in these six proposals, but I want to start big picture. Is there an antitrust problem that needs solving when it comes to these big technology companies?
Well, I think that really remains to be seen. The discipline of economics would tell us that monopoly problems most typically would manifest themselves in things like high prices, low innovation, stifled output, low quality, for instance. So I think the filter from an economist's perspective is to ask yourself the question, are these manifestations appearing in the tech sector from Google, Amazon, Apple, and so on? Are prices high, innovation low, output stifled, quality low? The study really needs yet to be done if you're going to really definitively answer that question. But at first blush, anyway, I think most people would say this is the very sector of our economy that has had exactly the opposite manifestations, that prices have been low and falling, that innovation's been quite high, output has exploded in this area, and quality's been quite high. So to the extent that these bills have arisen and have been motivated, it's a little tough from a traditional antitrust perspective to understand why they have arisen.
There has been the argument, John, I think from some, that maybe the old rules don't apply to technology companies the way they did, say, to an oil or steel company or something like that, that by the very nature of high technology industries, they're different. The concerns are different. What do you think of that broad notion?
Well, that's a tried and true argument, actually. It's been offered in a variety of sectors over the course of 100 years of antitrust. Different industries will say, well, or different parties will say or assert, this sector of the economy, whatever it is, this particular sector, the rail industry, the telecommunications industry, here the technology industry, just operates differently than the rest of the economy. So the traditional antitrust rules really don't capture fully the ability to make sure that they behave competitively. Now, over time, I will tell you that by and large, the antitrust laws have been really quite fluid in their enforcement and have captured the changes that have happened in our economy as it's evolved. So by and large, we've avoided technology-specific or sector-specific antitrust laws. We've really just generally operated on the basic premise that antitrust laws are designed to promote competition broadly in the economy and to advance the cause of consumers.
Talking to John Mayo from Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business, looking at a package of laws in the U.S. House aimed at least nibbling around the edges of changing antitrust laws when it comes to big technology companies. Think of the Facebooks, Googles, Apples, and more. You can join in with your thoughts on that idea or your questions at 800-642-1234. John, I want to start digging into the specific changes that are proposed here. One looks at mergers. It can make it harder for a company to acquire a potential competitor, also raising merger fees when that happens. That's been one criticism. I think the idea that we don't know if innovation is being stifled because, you know, Facebook, if they see a potential competitor, they buy them out. So we don't know what the competition might have been like. What do you think of that idea?
Well, the idea of anti-competitive practices arising from buying a nascent competitor are already part of the antitrust laws. The Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice have the authority today to go after companies to the extent that they do that. In this particular instance, there was a package of bills that, as you mentioned, just advanced through the House Judiciary Committee. Some of the bills are relatively innocuous on this. Some of them are a little more profound and substantive. On the more innocuous side, one of the bills will do is to give increased funding to the antitrust authorities to pursue merger challenges, including those that you just discussed, which would be a nascent competition case. So that's a pretty innocuous one that I think you're going to find really quite a bit of support for. Another one of the bills, though, in the package would really be much, much more profound and substantive, effectively imposing what's called a guilty until proven innocent standard on firms, any firm in the tech sector that is covered, so that if the firm were to try to merge with any tech company that's covered by the bill, tried to merge with another company, that merger would be under a standard that says the burden of proof would be on the tech company itself rather than on the plaintiff, in this case the government or a private party, to block the merger. And that's a pretty profound change.
Another change, I think this one mostly targeting Amazon, for example. Anti-competitive behavior, the accusation is when, say, I sell widgets on Amazon, Robco brand widgets. Amazon notices they're doing pretty well. They come up with their store brand of widgets, and then when our customer searches for them, they bump theirs to the top of the search results, or the concern, at least, that they could do that. Could you talk about that as a focus of these laws? Is this an anti-competitive problem that needs to be solved?
Yeah, great question. Today, and generally, it's not prohibited for a company to sell or promote its own, let's call them house brands. So, for example, if you're shopping at Costco, Costco offers the Kirkland store brand to compete against other products that are offered by retailers. Now, if you go to Walmart, Walmart has store brands that compete, let's say, against Procter & Gamble products. In general, house brands really have been shown to help create competition and bring prices down. So generally speaking, you'd think this is, from an economics perspective, a very good thing. At the same time, if a firm today uses a monopoly position to anti-competitively harm competition by excluding competitors, then the antitrust authorities can and have brought monopolization suits against the private party. So this issue of self-preferencing could be a very real issue. And the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission actually already have the authority to do this under the general antitrust laws. What this bill or a package of bills would do is to specifically target the tech sector in this space.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234 with Mike in West Allis. Mike, hi.
Hi. Thanks for this topic. I enjoy talking about technology, but When, you know, if we go all the way back to like when Microsoft was told that they need to unload the Internet Explorer from the Windows operating system, and we look at how technology has gone through these lawsuits after lawsuits, and they've yielded nothing in reality. I don't ever see that, except that the consumer ultimately always pays, if that's it. They've never harmed anyone. I don't think that. I think that we have this model of the auto industry in the 20s and trying to push that cookie cutter on top of a tech sector that is so much more, you know, amoebic and moves in so many different ways. And tech companies almost start to be bought by other tech companies in a way. There's a whole sector of that. And so it just seems like we're trying to fit an old kind of system onto this new technology, and it just doesn't seem to work right. It doesn't yield, I think, what we're looking for. And I'm kind of confused why we keep going after tech companies when we, especially Americans, are so dependent on technology moving at blistering speed so that we always have the latest and greatest. And it's in a way, it's why stifle this?
Mike, thanks for the call. John, what do you think?
Well, I think, Mike, you make some very good points. The business models themselves are changing really, really rapidly these days, especially in the tech space. And that has a lot of people scratching their heads about whether the new practices that they've adopted or are adopting are economically helpful or economically harmful. I think your point is really well taken, that it would be a real problem if what we did is to condemn new business models simply because we don't understand them. And we've seen some evidence that certainly in political circles, we don't always understand these new business models. And what we need to do maybe is to focus on consumer harm. Is there a consumer harm here? And a harm to competition, as opposed to just simply something that is new and scary. Also happens to be beneficial in a number of instances as well. So it could be both.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to John Mayo, professor of economics, business, and public policy at Georgetown University, looking at a package of antitrust bills in Congress aimed at big technology companies in particular, looking at what those laws would or could change if passed, not a done deal yet. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what action our antitrust laws allow the government to take without these changes even in place, and how it all applies to companies like Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon? Do you have concerns about how those companies operate, how big they've gotten? Do you think there needs to be more competition? What do you want to see from Congress, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with John Mayo, expert in antitrust law and a professor of economics, business, and public policy at Georgetown, looking at a group of new bills in Congress aimed at curbing the power of big technology companies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what you think about the power of big technology companies, if you're worried or you're glad you think you're getting good benefit out of that. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. John, some of the motivation for these changes seems to be non-economic in nature. I hear people on the left in Congress worried about the influence, the way ideas could spread on the Facebooks, especially of the world, in political culture. Conservatives also having the same concern, worried that conservative voices, they say, are stifled. Both agreeing, though, that these are, Facebook in particular, I think, has this really dominant influence on the spread of information in the country. Is that something worth thinking about in the context of antitrust?
Great question, Rob. I think this, you've just put your finger on a very important area. Earlier in our discussion, I mentioned that if you tried to put a traditional focus of antitrust of competition and consumer welfare on the tech sector, you sort of are challenged to say they're creating a real monopoly problem in this country. So if you start to look elsewhere, then what you see is from, let's say, the conspiracy wing of the Republican Party is irritated that platform companies have moderated free speech content. There's a concern by folks on the left that big companies are driving income inequality. There's a concern about the death of many small businesses at the same time that tech has grown up. And there's concerns about whether these large companies simply have too much political power. All of those are things that perhaps society should address. But the real question here is whether antitrust is an appropriate tool. Are we going to use a hammer instead of a screwdriver to solve the problem that the screw needs to get screwed into the wall? In the case of content moderation, the bills really just don't address content privacy or content issues at all. None of the particular bills address the issue of content moderation. On income inequality, economists have traditionally pointed towards tax policies being a far better tool than antitrust. For small businesses, you might think, gosh, is the role of competition or is the role of antitrust to protect small businesses per se or to promote a dynamic economy in which companies that come into the market thrive if they are efficient and do a good job and fail if they don't? And that's been part and parcel of our system for 200 years, and it's worked pretty well. And on the issue of political power, these are very large companies, and there may be legitimate concerns about the political power that they wield. But the question here is whether campaign finance reform might be a better tool. So there's, I think, going to be a pause at this juncture and maybe have folks asking the question, are there better vehicles to solve these problems than the antitrust hammer?
You briefly mentioned privacy there, and I think that's a concern some people have. If they want to participate in Facebook, they have to accept the terms of service and the idea that our data is out there and in the hands of someone else. I shouldn't pick just on Facebook, Amazon, Google, you name it. Is this a case where maybe more competition would, if there was a better alternative for somebody to break into one of these industries and say, hey, we're going to do what they do, but give you more privacy? Are we missing that? Is that an element of competition we're missing?
It would be really nice. It would be a lovely story if in fact, additional competition and the competition for quality and consumers' demand and desires for data privacy would drive that phenomena. It's not altogether clear that that's going to happen. You can imagine if there were two or three Facebooks, Facebook, Lacebook, and Notebook, if they were, would three companies solve the data privacy problem? I'd love it if that were the case, but we haven't really seen any indication that that's the case. In fact, as you may know, the companies themselves are in a particularly awkward position of asking for government regulation in this space. I think they themselves are asking for this. It's not clear that antitrust measures will solve that problem, but perhaps it will take a government action of some sort to do so.
Talking to John Mayo, economics professor at Georgetown University, looking at antitrust laws and big technology companies. A package of legislation in the House still has a ways to go before it would become a reality. John, I saw news today, an announcement from the Biden administration saying, hey, we're going to do a little more antitrust enforcement, not just focusing on technology, also so-called vertical integrations. When, say, a pharmacy company like CVS merges with a health insurance provider, say, for example. there is, I think, a general perception or often a perception that the government has backed away from antitrust, that they're asleep at the switch in some ways. Fair or not fair to say that?
That is part of the narrative. It turns out that a common claim is that one of the reasons we need this new set of antitrust laws is that the antitrust enforcers at the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission simply haven't been enforcing the existing laws. It turns out that in research that I did with colleagues here at Georgetown University, we looked at every merger that has been proposed since 1979, coming forward to 2020, and asked the question, what's actually happened to the probability of a merger challenge by the antitrust authorities over time? And according to the narrative, what you would expect is that the FTC and the Department of Justice have challenged fewer mergers. A lower percentage of mergers would be challenged. In fact, the likelihood of a challenge has actually doubled over time. And that's really in contrast to the narrative. It doesn't mean, however, the other thing that we found in our research is that if you want to see more enforcement, and this is no surprise, that if you increase agency budgets, they'll challenge more mergers. And that is part of the, I know the Biden administration's effort is to put some more money in the hands of the antitrust authorities. And even under the existing statutes, what you're going to see is more antitrust enforcement if they get larger budgets.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
I sure appreciate you having me on. Thank you very much, Rob.
John Mayo is professor of economics, business, and public policy at Georgetown University and director of Georgetown's Center for Business and Public Policy. He talked with us today about a package of six antitrust bills aimed at big technology companies. Those were approved by the House Judiciary Committee last week. Still have a ways to go on the floor of the House. And then there's always the Senate, too. Coming up after the news, TV game shows like Jeopardy and The Price is Right are being honored as an important piece of American entertainment history in a new archive. We'll learn more and ask you to share your favorite game shows of all time. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, the Biden administration is looking to crack down on gun dealers who don't follow the law as part of a wider effort to reduce gun violence. Get the details of the new plan tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York announced it will be the home of a new National Archives of Game Show History, the first of its kind. They hope to honor all the people who have shaped the industry from over the years, from big names like Vanna White, from Wheel of Fortune, to behind-the-scenes stories from producers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite game show of all time? Do you enjoy game shows or have some memories of watching them? Were you ever a participant on a game show? Love to hear what that was like, or part of a studio audience. Do you think they're an important part of our entertainment culture? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Chris Bench is chief curator of the National Archives of Game Show History at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester. We started a conversation with him earlier this month. Had some technical issues, or whammies, if you will, on our end. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Great being here.
Well, remind us, we talked to you just briefly before, remind us why we want to pay attention here to game shows as part of our pop culture history.
Well, I think the competition right now for the replacement host on Jeopardy makes clear that loads of people care about game shows, about their impact on popular culture, their impact on our lives, and that it's essential that we preserve this form in a way that hadn't been attended to before now.
Right. Can you talk about how maybe it's been overlooked so far? We don't have museums and archives tackling our game show history.
We don't. So I was thrilled about a year ago when two veteran producers of game shows came to us and said, we're missing out. Our legendary performers, our back of the house sorts of professionals, lots of people are passing on. We're missing out on preserving their stories. They have been such a big part of American popular culture, really from the days of radio, almost a century of game shows. And today, they are more present than ever before. More nighttime hours of broadcast television are devoted to game shows than even at what we consider the peak. And I bet loads of your listeners are current watchers or have heritages of their favorites from days gone by.
And if you're listening and you do have a favorite, you can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is your favorite game show? Do you have a favorite host? Have you ever been to one? Call 800-642-1234 as we talk to Chris Bench about a new National Archives of Game Show History. Chris, those stories you mentioned, that's going to be a focus, right? Can you talk about the sort of, oral histories you're hoping to collect?
That's right. We do want some of those front of the set kind of people, those hosts and hostesses, those announcers that we all think of when we think of our favorite shows. But we also want the multitude of people who go together to make these shows happen. Who could think of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire without the lighting designer who created that dramatic spotlight effect when people are answering questions, or the jingles and sounds, or the mechanical devices that turn clues on the screen, and those have moved into digital realms. So much, so many facets of craft and artistry and forethought to make these successful products.
Well, you mentioned Jeopardy. I want to give a listen to a moment from the long-running show, a bit of a funny moment from contestants Max and Kevin on the show. The category, Most Populous Nation.
Populous Nation, 400.
Israel, Lebanon, Syria. Max.
What is Israel?
No. Kevin.
What is Syria?
Right.
Nation, 600.
Switzerland, Sweden, Swaziland. Max.
What is Switzerland?
No. Kevin.
What is Sweden?
Right.
Nation, 800.
Pakistan, Bangladesh, Indonesia. Max.
What is Pakistan?
No. Kevin.
What is Indonesia?
Yes.
Most populous nation, 1,000.
Portugal, Colombia, Peru. Max.
What is Peru?
No. Kevin.
What is Colombia?
Right. Oh. No fun for Max, but a good run for
process of elimination there, I guess, Chris. And that, I mean, that also illustrated one of the things that I liked about Jeopardy. It's like bang, 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 question after question, not lots of chit chat in between. I don't know. Is that part of the appeal of why Jeopardy is such a standout among talk shows or game shows?
It is. And in fact, I was participating in a conversation with one of our co-founders, Bob Bowden, recently, who's produced so many shows. And his analysis of Jeopardy was the top level of questions, or I should say answers on the board, are ones that practically everyone can get. In between that and that bottom row, there are lots of ones that you can say, oh, I almost knew that, or you can shout out an answer. And that lowest row, the most difficult ones, are ones that you sort of say, wow, that's fascinating. I never knew that. So different ways for all the viewers to feel good about themselves as well as excited about shouting out those answers in their home, family room, or living room.
Now, getting back to the archive, you're not just interested in oral histories. You're also, I understand, hoping to get some stuff. What kind of physical artifacts are you on the hunt for?
We would love things called shell scripts. That's what the overall structure of a game show episode looks like, because it's very structured and thought out beforehand. I am currently getting tickets from game show studio audience members. I am waiting for the delivery of a category card from a winning participant on the $20,000 pyramid. So things that represent the studio audience, represent the contestants, represent the craft that goes into making these shows. All of those are things we hope to get. Plus those really showy items. We want the wheel from the Wheel of Fortune if we can get it, or the pyramid from Pyramid.
I know, I believe with your other exhibits at the Museum of Play, there are some hands-on and interactive things. Are you, Chris, going to host your own game show there?
I am looking forward to that. In fact, we have game show contestants on our staff here. Our archivist, Julia Novakovic, has been a contestant on Jeopardy, on Millionaire as well. So she can speak to what it's like being on the set. And we are hoping that everyone, when we get around in a few years to doing a game show exhibit, you'll feel like you are the contestant right there with the answers, meeting the challenges.
Now, of course, when I think game show, I think TV game show, Chris. But I think you've mentioned before to us that a lot of these started, this whole genre started on radio, which I want to hear more about. Are you looking to tap into that era as well?
That would be lovely. That's reaching a little bit back further into our history. So, but people transitioned from radio to television in so many ways, whether that was variety shows or comedy. And maybe there are a few long-term veterans who got their start in radio and have those memories to share with us today. I would love to get that continuity.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Oleg is with us in La Crosse. Oleg, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about?
I want to tell you, so I am a first-generation immigrant to America. My parents immigrated when I was 12 years old, and I remember the first game show that caught my attention was The Price is Right with Bob Barker as the host. You know, can't get much more classic than that. And I remember, you know, I was 12 years old, and my English wasn't even perfect yet. And by rights, what did I care about prices of consumer goods? But Bob Barker had such an inimitable style and was such a great showman that I tuned in every day to this show, just to hear him, take people through this game of guessing prices of consumer goods.
Awesome. Oleg, thank you so much for sharing that story. I want to give a listen to The Price is Right. Contestants here guessing the price of a Honda Elite 80 motor scooter to get a chance to participate on stage.
And you get to bid on this first, Barbara.
$1,700.
$1,700, Michael.
Exactly, $2,148.
His bid is $2,148. That's an interesting bid. How did you settle on $2,148?
I seen that on there last week, and that was the exact price. I know that's what it is. I watch you every day. I watch you every day, Bob.
Well, Oleg and that contestant watched every day, Chris. And also we heard on Facebook from Brandy, who has memories of watching The Price is Right. Ah, and I remember doing this too, when Brandy was homesick as a kid. The Price is Right. Could you talk about where that stands as you're looking at the history of game shows?
You know, some of these shows are truly evergreen. They go on for decades, and people sort of pass them along as family traditions. Is this what you do while you watch, as you have dinner every night or before dinner or some kind of structure? So we really build so much of our behaviors around some of these shows that get incredible longevity and incredible loyalty from the audience.
Oleg, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing your story. We are talking about game shows, past and present, with Chris Bench, chief curator of the National Toy Hall of Fame at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. Their new addition there, a TV game show history archive, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite game show, past and present? Was it a routine for you to watch this show at this time every day? Have you ever watched Jeopardy at a bar with friends and strangers trying to beat each other to guess the answers? Do you have a game show that just didn't strike you as a very good one? Why? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Chris Bench, Chief Curator of the National Toy Hall of Fame at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. We're talking about game shows, their history, their new archive at that museum. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Want to hear your favorite game show or your favorite game show watching memory, or if you've ever been a part of a studio audience, you could share that experience too. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard on Facebook from Darren when we asked about shows, Match Game. And Chris, that reminds me, there were a whole bunch of shows back in the 70s, I think, and early 80s that I remember watching as a kid, often what maybe while homesick from school. They often had B-list celebrities who I only knew because they were on, like Paul Lynde on Hollywood Squares. What are you looking for to tell the story of that era, of those shows that aren't with us anymore?
That is definitely something that taps into my personal memories. Yes, Hollywood Squares was one of my guilty pleasures when I was home with the flu and a little bright spot in the draggy day of drinking ginger ale and napping. So those kinds of things, yes, those B-list celebrities who took that niche on the television game shows and ran with it. And one of the things that I love is that so many of us wanted to be on those shows so much that we bought the board game version. There were so many of those out there. Password, Hollywood Squares, Jeopardy, Price is Right. All of those had game versions for the home audience, and you could play it around the card table and see whether you could do as well as the TV contestants.
Well, now knowing you as I do, Chris, I'm guessing that the Museum of Play already has some of those home games on hand, right?
We do. So I've been looking for those. We have them in tabletop versions. We also have them in their computer and video game versions. And we are looking for more. We don't have all of those. So I just told a donor that we would love about 50 of his personal games of that home consumer variety.
Well, if you have the home version of a famous game show, love to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Still time for you to call in with your personal favorite game show of all time, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Chris, we're hearing from more people online than on the phone. Maybe that means something. I don't know, but we heard from James, who says the most interesting game show he ever watched was called Mastermind on the BBC when he was over there for a summer. He always thought PBS could try an American version of the show. I have never seen that. I know there have been a lot of game shows, including Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, that have moved from country to country.
There are, and Mastermind has a reputation amongst game show fans of being really brainy. And I can see why the PBS connection is there. And there was also a really successful, very popular home version of Mastermind. So that is an excellent one. Some of these are out there on streaming services, and some of them are also available for easy pickup on things like YouTube.
All right. Here's a, Chris, a philosophical question that I put way too much time into thinking about over the years. And it matters for your archive. When Survivor came out, right? People call it a reality TV show, but people were competing to win a prize at the end. It was Survivor, and are shows like that game shows that'll fit into your purview there?
That is such a perfect question, Rob. We were just having that conversation last week as we were defining some parameters. And the famous quote about pornography was, I know it when I see it. And sometimes game shows are what you believe them to be. Is it The Bachelor? You're winning a spouse, or any of those dimensions. They're on a sliding scale. It's even trickier with things like cooking shows, where you're showing off a skill, you're winning, you're competing. I am most inclined to think of the ones that your listeners are bringing up so far, the ones that have an established host, have a studio audience. Some of those, they're definitely the classic core definition of what a game show is, but it gets blurry, as you say, around the edges with cash prizes and winners and losers on loads of those reality shows.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us in Racine. Lynn, hi.
Hi. Yes, I've never been one to exercise on a regular basis. COVID and Drew Carey and The Price is Right, though, have got me into good shape. I exercise with Drew every morning at 10, with very few exceptions. So thanks to Drew and The Price is Right, he's my little guilty pleasure. That's my favorite game show.
Lynn, do you guess the prices? And do you ever guess the price correctly?
Not the price on the nose, but yeah, I play. And I've actually gone to see the live show, the traveling show. I've taken my mother and my son. So, I have done that.
Fantastic. So. Lynn, thank you so much for sharing that. So Lynn fits into her exercise routine. The Price is Right. That's probably the right level of concentration for me. That makes a lot of sense, don't you think, Chris?
Yes, that's about my endurance capacity to do a half-hour game show. Perfect.
I love it, Lynn. Thanks for that. We'll go to Marcus now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, no whammies, and stop. Press your luck.
That, you know, it's funny, Marcus, because the big bucks, no whammies, that phrase sticks with me. I have to really think about which show it came from. That was Press Your Luck, you're saying?
Yeah, it was Press Your Luck. The other one I liked, though, was, stay home from school kind of sick day. Was Hollywood Squares with Joan Rivers.
With Joan Rivers. Okay, Marcus, thank you so much for sharing that. Chris, Hollywood Squares is at that rotating cast. I know Paul Lynn was the center square. Joan Rivers was on it. Gilbert Gottfried was the center square for a long time. I don't know. It's providing a lot of work for celebrities over the years.
It did. And there were writers behind all of that. So they were sharp comedians, but they needed good content. And what we forget is they had lines and quips given to them, and they were scripts and jokes that we would love to capture and preserve for all time.
Marcus, thanks for a lot for that. And that reminded me, the catchphrases of, you know, is that your final answer? Big bucks, no whammies, Marcus just mentioned. Survey Says from Family Feud, which we haven't talked to. Those are ways that they've really crept into American pop culture, Chris.
That's part of our language. Everyone understands those structures and those phrases. So, yes, they are really integral to who we are today.
All right, Chris, I got to ask you the big question. Would you be good on Jeopardy? You know, in the moment, you're actually there in the studio. Do you think you could pull off a win?
I had a friend from graduate school who was on, and she was a smart woman, but she said her downfall was her buzzer skill. She wasn't hair trigger enough to actually press the button and get ahead of the other players. I worry that would be my downfall.
All right. And do you have a favorite show of all time that you'd love to go back and watch and maybe feature prominently at the archive?
I was a pyramid guy growing up. And as the price range has escalated, I will date myself by saying I was watching when it was merely the $20,000 pyramid.
Excellent. Chris, thanks as always for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Rob. You're a winner.
You too. That's Chris Bench, Chief Curator of the National Archives of Game Show History at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. He joined us to talk about the brand new archive they have there and the impact of game shows on American pop culture and entertainment history. You can still let us know your favorite game show of all time. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, scroll down a bit to find that conversation, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, just with the name of a game show that you love or loved in the past. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, polarization and a loss of trust in institutions may be headed to your local government. A politics expert tells us you're going to feel the difference with the loss of services maybe at the local level. There's a whole world of famous people that you and I might never have heard of. We'll explore the world of internet fame, and we'll look at the death of the hit TV show. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Here's a question that's interesting to me as someone who plays a wind instrument. How much virus can you spread while you're playing, and is there a way for musicians to limit the risk? A new study tried to put that to the test and found out the best bet is to turn things inside out. As reported in the New York Times, researchers worked at the Utah Symphony to figure out the best ways to limit the risk of disease spread. The symphony was interested because of COVID, but the research could help with other viral illnesses. I'm a little less interested because I play saxophone, which you don't usually see in your symphony orchestra. Anyhow, researchers found that by changing the traditional seating arrangement, you could limit exposure to those droplets that wind players shoot through their instruments. Yeah, music is gross. The key, getting the instruments that put out the most droplets toward the edges near open doors on the side and then pointing them away from everybody else. So who's the big droplet producer? According to the study anyway, number three is the trombone at 300 particles per liter of air exhaled through the instrument. Number two is the oboe, 400 particles per liter. Number one, trumpet, a whopping 2,500 particles per liter. So I've got a better solution than moving the trumpets to the edge. Keep moving them out the door. Replace them with some saxophones. It's music news you can use. This is Central Time.